This is Audible.
Audible Modern Vanguard presents A Prayer for Owen Meany by John Irving. Narrated by Joe Barrett.
When school began again, when we started the fall term of 1959, I realized that the voice had not been idle for the summer. Owen came back to school with a stack of columns ready for the grave. He charged the search committee to find a new headmaster who was dedicated to serving the faculty and the students.
Not a servant of the alumni and the trustees!
Although he made fun of Thorny, particularly of old Archie Thorndike's notion of the whole boy, Owen praised our departing headmaster for being
an educator first, a fundraiser second.
Owen cautioned the search committee to
beware of the Board of Trustees. They'll pick a headmaster who cares more about fund drives than the curriculum or the faculty who teach it. And don't listen to the alumni,
warned the voice. Owen had a low opinion of the alumni.
They can't even be trusted to remember what it was really like to be here. They're always talking about what the school did for them or how the school made something out of them, as if they were unformed clay when they came here. As for how harsh the school could be, as for how miserable they were when they were students, the alumni have conveniently forgotten.
Someone in faculty meeting called Owen that little turd. Dan Needham argued that Owen truly adored the school, but that a Gravesend education did not and should not teach respect for uncritical love, for blind devotion. It became harder to defend Owen when he started the petition against fish on Fridays.
We have a non-denominational church, he stated. Why do we have a Catholic dining hall? If Catholics want to eat fish on Friday, why must the rest of us join them? Most kids hate fish. Serve fish, but serve something else, too. Cold cuts, or even peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. We are free to listen to the guest preacher at Heard's church, or we can attend any of the town churches of our choice. Jews aren't forced to take communion. Unitarians aren't dragged to Mass or to confession. Baptists aren't rounded up on Saturdays and herded off to synagogue or to their own unwilling circumcisions. Yet non-Catholics must eat fish. On Fridays, it's eat fish or go hungry. I thought this was a democracy. Are we all forced to subscribe to the Catholic view of birth control? Why are we forced to eat Catholic food?
He set up a chair and desk in the school post office to collect signatures for his petition. Naturally, everyone signed it.
Even the Catholics signed it,
announced the voice. Dan Needham said that the food service manager put on quite a show in faculty meeting.
Next thing you know, that little turd will want a salad bar. He'll want an alternative to every menu, not just fish on Fridays.
In his first column, the voice had attacked
mystery meat.
Now it was fish.
This unjust imposition encourages religious persecution, said the voice.
Owen saw signs of anti-Catholicism springing up everywhere.
There's some bad talk going around, he reported. The climate of the school is becoming discriminatory. I hear the offensive slur, mackerel snapper. And you never used to hear that kind of talk around here.
Frankly, I never heard anyone use the term mackerel snapper, except Owen. And we couldn't pass St. Michael's, not to mention the sainted statue of Mary Magdalene, without his saying,
I wonder what the penguins are up to. Do you think they're all lesbians?
It was the first Friday following Thanksgiving vacation when they served cold cuts and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches with the standard fish dish. You could also get a bowl of tomato soup and potato salad. He had won. He got a standing ovation in the dining hall. As a scholarship boy, he had a job. He was a waiter at a faculty table. The serving tray was half his size, and he stood at attention beside it as if it were a shield, while the students applauded him and the faculty smiled a trifle stiffly. Old Thorny called him into his office.
You know, I like you, little fella, he told Owen. You're a go-getter.
but let me give you some advice. Your friends don't watch you as closely as your enemies, and you've got enemies. You've made more enemies in less than 2 years than I've made in more than 20. Be careful, you don't give your enemies a way to get you. Thorny wanted Owen to cox the varsity crew. Owen was the perfect size for a coxswain, and, after all, he'd grown up on the Squam Squad. But Owen said that the racing shells had always offended his father.
"It's a matter of blood being thicker than school," he told the headmaster.
Furthermore, the river was polluted. In those days, the town didn't have a proper sewage system. The textile mill, my late grandfather's former shoe factory, and many private homes simply dumped their waste into the Squam Squad. Owen said he had often seen beetle skins floating in the river. Beetle skins still gave him the shivers. Besides, in the fall he liked soccer. Of course, he wasn't on the varsity or the junior varsity, but he had fun playing soccer, even on the lowest club level. He was fast and scrappy, although from all his smoking he was easily winded. And in the spring, the other season for crew, Owen liked to play tennis. He wasn't very good, he was just a beginner. But my grandmother bought him a good racket, and Owen appreciated the orderliness of the game. The straight white lines, the proper tension in the net at its exactly correct height, the precise scoring. In the winter, God knows why, he liked basketball. Perversely, perhaps, because it was a tall boy's game. He played only in pickup games, to be sure. He could never have played on any of the teams. But he played with enthusiasm. He was quite a leaper. He had a jump shot that elevated him almost to eye level with the other players, and he became obsessed with an impossible frill of the game. Impossible for him. The slam dunk. We didn't call it a slam dunk then. We called it stuffing the ball, and there wasn't very much of it. Most kids weren't tall enough. Of course, Owen could never leap high enough to be above the basket. To stuff the ball down into the basket was a nonsense idea he had. It was his absurd goal. He would devise an approach to the basket. Dribbling at good speed, he would time his leap to coincide with the teammate's readiness to lift him higher. He would jump into a teammate's waiting arms, and the teammate would, occasionally, boost Owen above the basket's rim. I was the only one who was willing to practice the timing with him. It was such a ridiculous thing for him to want to do. For someone his size to set himself the challenge of soaring and reaching so high, it was just silliness. And I tired of the mindless, repetitive choreography. "Why are we doing this?" I'd ask him. "It would never work in a game. It's probably not even legal. I can't lift you up to the basket. I'm sure that's not allowed." But Owen reminded me that I had once enjoyed lifting him up at Sunday school. Now that it mattered to him to get the timing of his leap adjusted to my lifting him even higher, why couldn't I simply indulge him without criticizing him?
"I tolerated you lifting me up all those years when I asked you not to," he said.
"All those years," I repeated. "It was only a few Sunday school classes. It was only for a couple of years, and we didn't do it every time." But it was important to him now, this crazy lifting him up, and so we did it. It became a very well-rehearsed stunt with us. Slam Dunk Meanie, some of the boys on the basketball team began to call him. Slam Dunk Master, after he'd perfected the move. Even the basketball coach was appreciative. "I may use you in a game, Owen," the coach said, joking with him.
"It's not for a game,"
said Owen Meanie, who had his own reasons for everything. That Christmas vacation of 59, we were in the Gravesend gym for hours every day. We were alone and undisturbed. All the boarders had gone home, and we were full of contempt for the Eastmans, who appeared to be making a point of not inviting us to Sawyer Depot. Noah and Simon had brought a friend home from California. Hester was in and out, and some old friend of my Aunt Martha, from her university days, might be visiting. The real reason we were not invited, Owen and I were sure, was that Aunt Martha wanted to discourage the relationship between Owen and Hester. Hester had told Owen that her mother referred to him as the boy who hit that ball, and as that strange little friend of John's, and that boy my mother is dressing up like a little doll. But Hester thought so ill of her mother, and she was such a troublemaker, she might have made up all that and told Owen, chiefly so that Owen would dislike Aunt Martha, too. Owen didn't seem to care. I had been granted an extension to make up 2 late-term papers over the vacation, so it wasn't much of a vacation anyway. Owen helped me with the history paper, and he wrote the English paper for me.
I purposely didn't spell everything correctly. I made a few grammatical errors, of the kind you usually make, he told me. I repeated myself occasionally, and there's no mention of the middle of the book, as if you skipped that part. That's the part you skipped, right?
It was a problem. How my in-class writing, my quizzes and examinations, were not at all as good as the work Owen helped me with. But we studied for all announced tests together, and I was, gradually, improving as a student. Because of my weak spelling, I was enrolled in an extra remedial course, which was marginally insulting, and, also because of my spelling and my often erratic performance when I was called upon in the classroom, I was asked to see the school psychiatrist once a week. Gravesend Academy was used to good students. When someone struggled academically, even when one simply couldn't spell properly, it was assumed to be a matter for a shrink. The voice had something to say about that, too.
It seems to me that people who don't learn as easily as others suffer from a kind of learning disability. There is something that interferes with the way they perceive numbers and letters. There is something different about the way they comprehend unfamiliar material. But I fail to see how this disability is improved by psychiatric consultation. What seems to be lacking is a technical ability that those of us called good students are born with. Someone should concretely study these skills and teach them. What does a shrink have to do with the process?
These were the days before we'd heard about dyslexia and other learning disabilities. Students like me were simply thought to be stupid or slow. It was Owen who isolated my problem.
You're mainly slow, he said. You're almost as smart as I am, but you need twice the time.
The school psychiatrist, a retired Swiss gentleman who returned every summer to Zurich, was convinced that my difficulties as a student were the result of my best friend's murder of my mother and the tensions and conflicts that he saw as the inevitable result of my dividing my life between my grandmother and my stepfather.
At times, you must hate him, yes?
Dr. Dolder mused. Hate who? I asked. My stepfather? No, I love Dan.
Your best friend. At times you hate him, yes?
Dr. Dolder asked. No, I said. I love Owen. It was an accident.
Yes, I know, Dr. Dolder said. But nonetheless, your grandmother, perhaps, she is a most difficult reminder, yes?
A reminder? I said. I love my grandmother.
Yes, I know, Dr. Dolder said. But this baseball business, it's most difficult, I imagine.
Yes, I said. I hate baseball.
Yes, for sure, Dr. Dolder said. I've never seen a game, so it's hard for me to imagine exactly. Perhaps we should take in a game together?
No, I said. I don't play baseball. I don't even watch it.
Yes, I see, Dr. Dolder said. You hate it that much, I see.
I can't spell, I said. I'm a slow reader. I get tired. I have to keep my finger on the particular sentence or I'll lose my place.
It must be rather hard, a baseball, Dr. Dolder said. Yes?
Yes, it's very hard, I said. I sighed.
Yes, I see, Dr. Dolder said. Are you tired now? Are you getting tired?
It's the spelling, I told him. The spelling and the reading. There were photographs on the wall of his office in the Hubbard Infirmary. They were old black-and-white photographs of the clock faces on the church spires in Zurich, and photographs of the water birds in the Lamat. and of the people feeding the birds from those funny, arched footbridges. Many of the people wore hats. You could almost hear those cathedral clocks sounding the hour. Dr. Dolder had a quizzical expression on his long, goat-shaped face. His silver-white Van Dyke beard was neatly trimmed, but the doctor often tugged its point.
"A baseball," he said thoughtfully. "Next time, you will bring a baseball, yes?"
"Yes, of course," I said.
"And this little baseball hitter, the voice, yes? I would very much like to talk to him, too," said Dr. Dolder.
"I'll ask Owen if he's free," I said.
"Not a chance," said Owen Meany when I asked him. "There's nothing the matter with my spelling."
Toronto, May 11th, 1987. I regret that I had the right change to get the Globe and Mail out of the street corner box. I had 3 dimes in my pocket, and a sentence in a front-page article proved irresistible. It was unclear how Mr. Reagan intended to have his administration maintain support for the Contras while remaining within the law. Since when did Mr. Reagan care about remaining within the law? I wish the president would spend a weekend with a Miami model. He could do a lot less harm that way. Think how relieved the Nicaraguans would be, if only for a weekend. We ought to find a model for the president to spend every weekend with. If we could tire the old geezer out, he wouldn't be capable of more damaging mischief. Oh, what a nation of moralists the Americans are. With what fervor do they relish bringing their sexual misconduct to light? A pity that they do not bring their moral outrage to bear on their president's arrogance above the law. A pity that they do not unleash their moral zest on an administration that runs guns to terrorists. But, of course, boudoir morality takes less imagination and can be indulged in without the effort of keeping up with world affairs or even bothering to know the whole story behind the sexual adventure. It's sunny again in Toronto today. The fruit trees are blossoming, especially the pears and apples and crab apples. There's a chance of showers. Owen liked the rain. In the summer, in the bottom of a quarry, it could be brutally hot, and the dust was always a factor. The rain cooled the rock slabs. The rain held the dust down.
"All quarrymen like rain," said Owen Meany.
I told my grade 12 English class that they should reread what Hardy called the first phase of Tess of the D'Urbervilles, the part called The Maiden. Although I had drawn their attention to Hardy's fondness for foreshadowing, the class was especially sleepy-headed at spotting these devices. How could they have read over the death of the horse so carelessly? "Nobody blamed Tess as she blamed herself," Hardy writes. He even says, "Her face was dry and pale, as though she regarded herself in the light of a murderess." And what did the class make of Tess's physical appearance? It was a luxuriance of aspect, a fullness of growth, which made her appear more of a woman than she really was. They made nothing of it. "Don't some of you look like that to yourselves?" I asked the class. "What do you think about when you see one of yourselves who looks like that?" Silence. And what did they think happened at the end of the first phase? Was Tess seduced, or was she raped? "She was sleeping soundly," Hardy writes. Does he mean that D'Urberville did it to her when she was asleep? Silence. Before they trouble themselves to read the second phase of Tess, called Maiden No More, I suggested that they trouble themselves to reread The Maiden, or perhaps read it for the first time, as the case may be. "Pay attention," I warned them. "When Tess says, 'Did it ever strike your mind that what every woman says some women may feel?' Pay attention. Pay attention to where Tess's child is buried, in that shabby corner of God's allotment, where he lets the nettles grow, and where all unbaptized infants, notorious drunkards, suicides, and others of the conjecturally damned are laid. Ask yourself what Hardy thinks of God's allotment, and what does he think of bad luck, of coincidence, of so-called circumstances beyond our control? And does he imagine that being a virtuous character exposes you to greater or fewer liabilities as you roam the world?
Sir,
said Leslie Ann Grew. That was very old-fashioned of her. It's been years since anyone called me sir at Bishop Strawn, unless it was a new kid. Leslie Ann Grew has been here for years.
If it's another nice day tomorrow, said Leslie Ann, can we have class outside?
No, I said. But I'm so slow. I feel so dull. I know what the voice would have told her.
Only if it rains,
Owen would have said.
If it pours, then we can have class outside.
At the start of the winter term of our 10th grade year at Gravesend Academy, the school's gouty minister, the Reverend Mr. Scammon, the officiant of the Academy's non-denominational faith and the lackluster teacher of our religion and scripture classes, cracked his head on the icy steps of Heard's Church and failed to regain consciousness. Owen was of the opinion that the Reverend Mr. Scammon never was fully conscious. For weeks after his demise, his vestments and his cane hung from the coat tree in the vestry office, as if old Mr. Scammon had journeyed no farther from this world than to the adjacent toilet. The Reverend Lewis Merrill was hired as his temporary replacement in our religion and scripture classes, and a search committee was formed to find a new school minister. Owen and I had suffered through Religion One together in our 9th grade year, old Mr. Scammon's sweeping Caesar to Eisenhower approach to the major religions of the world. We had been suffering Scammon's scripture course, and his religion too, when the icy steps of Heard's Church rose to meet him. The Reverend Mr. Merrill brought his familiar stutter and his almost as familiar doubts to both courses. In scripture, he set us to work in our Bibles to find plentiful examples of Isaiah 5:20, "Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil." In religion, too, a heavy reading course in religion and literature, we were instructed to divine Tolstoy's meaning. There was no solution, Tolstoy writes in Anna Karenina, but the universal solution that life gives to all questions, even the most complex and insoluble. That answer is, one must live in the needs of the day. That is, forget oneself. In both classes, Pastor Merrill preached his doubt is the essence of and not the opposite of faith philosophy. It was a point of view that interested Owen more than it had once interested him. The apparent secret was belief without miracles. A faith that needed a miracle was not a faith at all. Don't ask for proof. That was Mr. Merrill's routine message.
But everyone needs a little proof, said Owen Meany.
Faith itself is a miracle, Owen, said Pastor Merrill. The first miracle that I believe in is my own faith itself. Owen looked doubtful, but he didn't speak. Our Religion II class, and our Scripture class, too, was an atheistic mob. Except for Owen Meany, we were such a negative, anti-everything bunch of morons that we thought Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg were more interesting writers than Tolstoy. And so the Reverend Lewis Merrill, with his stutter and his well-worn case of doubt, had his hands full with us. He made us read Green's The Power and the Glory. Owen wrote his term paper on
The Whiskey Priest, a Seedy Saint.
We also read Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, and Lagerkvist's Barabbas, and Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov. Owen wrote my term paper on
Sin and Smerdyakov, a Lethal Combination.
Poor Pastor Merrill. My old Congregationalist minister was suddenly cast in the role of Christianity's defender, and even Owen argued with the terms of Mr. Merrill's defense. The class loved Sartre and Camus. The concept of the unyielding evidence of a life without consolation was thrilling to us teenagers. The Reverend Mr. Merrill countered humbly with Kierkegaard, "What no person has a right to is to delude others into the belief that faith is something of no great significance, or that it is an easy matter, whereas it is the greatest and most difficult of all things. Owen, who'd had his doubts about Pastor Merrill, found himself in the role of the minister's defender.
Just because a bunch of atheists are better writers than the guys who wrote the Bible doesn't necessarily make them right, he said crossly. Look at those weirdo TV miracle workers. They're trying to get people to believe in magic. But the real miracles aren't anything you can see. They're things you have to believe without seeing. If some preacher's an asshole, that's not proof that God doesn't exist.
Yes, but let's not say asshole in class, Owen, Pastor Merrill said. And in our scripture class, Owen said,
It's true that the disciples are stupid. They never understand what Jesus means. They're a bunch of bunglers. They don't believe in God as much as they want to believe, and they even betray Jesus. The point is, God doesn't love us because we're smart or because we're good. We're stupid and we're bad, and God loves us anyway. Jesus already told the dumb shit disciples what was going to happen. The Son of Man will be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. Remember? That was in Mark, right?
Yes, but let's not say dumb shit disciples in class, Owen, Mr. Merrill said. But although he struggled to defend God's holy word, Lewis Merrill, for the first time in my memory, appeared to be enjoying himself. To have his faith assailed perked him up. He was livelier and less meek.
I don't think the Congregationalists ever talked to him, Owen suggested. I think he's lonely for conversation. Even if all he gets is an argument, at least we're talking to him.
I see no evidence that his wife ever talks to him, Dan Needham observed. And the monosyllabic utterances of Pastor Merrill's surly children were not of the engaging tones that invited conversation.
Why does this school waste its time with two search committees? Asked the voice in the grave. Find a headmaster. We need a headmaster, but we don't need a school minister. With no disrespect for the dead, the Reverend Lewis Merrill is a more than adequate replacement for the late Mr. Scammon. Frankly, Mr. Merrill is an improvement in the classroom, and the school thinks well enough of his powers in the pulpit to have already invited him to be the guest preacher at Hurd's Church on several occasions. The Reverend Mr. Merrill would be a good school minister. We should find out what the Congregationalists are paying him and offer him more.
And so they hired him away from the Congregationalists. Once more, the voice did not go unheard. Toronto, May 12, 1987. A sunny, cool day. A good day to mow a lawn. The smell of freshly cut grass all along Russell Hill Road reflects how widespread is my neighbor's interest in lawn mowing. Mrs. Brocklebank, whose daughter Heather is in my grade 12 English class, took a slightly different approach to her lawn. I found her ripping her dandelions out by their roots.
You'd better do the same thing, she said to me. Pull them out. Don't mow them under. If you chop them up with the mower, you'll just make more of them.
Like starfish, I said. I should have known better. It's never a good idea to introduce Mrs. Brocklebank to a new subject, not unless you have time to kill. If I'd assigned the maiden to Mrs. Brocklebank, she would have gotten everything right the first time.
What do you know about starfish? She asked.
I grew up on the seacoast, I reminded her. It is occasionally necessary for me to tell Torontonians of the presence of the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. They tend to think of the Great Lakes as the waters of the world.
So what about starfish? Mrs. Brocklebank asked.
You cut them up, they grow more starfish, I said.
Is that in a book?
Asked Mrs. Brocklebank. I assured her that it was. I even have a book that describes the life of the starfish, although Owen and I knew not to chop them up long before we read about them. Every kid in Gravesend learned all about starfish at the beach at Little Boar's Head. I remember my mother telling Owen and me not to cut them up. Starfish are very destructive, and their powers of reproduction are not encouraged in New Hampshire. Mrs. Brocklebank is persistent regarding new information. She goes after everything as aggressively as she attacks her dandelions. I'd like to see that book, she announced. And so I began again with what has become a fairly routine labor, discouraging Mrs. Brocklebank from reading another book. I work as hard at discouraging her, and with as little success, as I sometimes labor to encourage those BSS girls to read their assignments. It's not a very good book, I said. It's written by an amateur. It's published by a vanity press. So what's wrong with an amateur writing a book? Mrs. Brocklebank wanted to know. She is probably writing one of her own, it occurs to me now. So what's wrong with the vanity press? She asked. The book that tells the truth about the starfish is called The Life of the Tide Pool by Archibald Thorndike. Old Thorny was an amateur naturalist and an amateur diarist, and after he retired from Gravesend Academy, he spent 2 years scrutinizing a tide pool in Rye Harbor. At his own expense, he published a book about it and sold autographed copies of the book every alumni day. He parked his station wagon by the tennis courts and sold his books off the tailgate, chatting with all the alumni who wanted to talk to him. Since he was a very popular headmaster, and since he was replaced by a particularly unpopular headmaster, almost all the alumni wanted to talk to old Thorny. I suppose he sold a lot of copies of The Life of the Tide Pool. He might even have made money. Maybe he wasn't such an amateur after all. He knew how to handle the voice, by not handling him. And the voice would prove to be the undoing of the new headmaster, in the end. In the end, I yielded to Mrs. Brocklebank's frenzy to educate herself. I said I'd lend her my copy of The Life of the Tide Pool. Be sure to remind Heather to reread the first phase of Tess, I told Mrs. Brocklebank. Heather's not reading her assignments? Mrs. Brocklebank asked in alarm. It's spring, I reminded her. All the girls aren't reading their assignments. Heather's doing just fine. Indeed, Heather Brocklebank is one of my better students. She has inherited her mother's ardor, while at the same time her imagination ranges far beyond dandelions. In a flash, I think of giving my grade 12 English class a sneak quiz. If they gave the first phase of Tess such a sloppy reading, I'll bet they skipped the introduction altogether. And I had assigned the introduction, too. I don't always do that, but there's an introduction by Robert B. Heilman that's especially helpful to first readers of Hardy. I know a really nasty quiz question, I think, looking at Mrs. Brocklebank, clutching her murdered dandelions. What was Thomas Hardy's earlier title for Tess? Ha! It's nothing they could ever guess. If they'd read the introduction, they'd know it was Too Late, Beloved. They'd at least remember the Too Late part. Then I remembered that Hardy had written a story before Tess called The Romantic Adventures of a Milkmaid. I wondered if I could throw in that title to confuse them. Then I remembered that Mrs. Brocklebank was standing on the sidewalk with her handful of dandelions, waiting for me to fetch her The Life of the Tide Pool. And last of all, I remembered that Owen Meany and I first read Tess of the D'Urbervilles in our 10th grade year at Gravesend Academy. We were in Mr. Early's English class. It was the winter term of 1960, and I was struggling with Thomas Hardy to the point of tears. Mr. Early was a fool to try Tess on 10th graders. At Bishop Strawn, I have long argued with my colleagues that we should teach Hardy in grade 13. Even grade 12 is too soon. Even the Brothers Karamazov is easier than Tess. I can't read this, I remember saying to Owen. He tried to help me. He helped me with everything else, but Tess was simply too difficult. I can't read about milking cows, I screamed.
It's not about milking cows, Owen said crossly.
I don't care what it's about. I hate it, I said.
That's a truly intelligent attitude, Owen said. If you can't read it, do you want me to read it aloud to you?
I am so ashamed of myself to remember this, that he would do even that for me, that he would read Tess of the D'Urbervilles aloud to me. At the time, the thought of hearing that whole novel in his voice was staggering.
I can't read it, and I can't listen to it either, I said.
Fine, Owen said. Then you tell me what you want me to do. I can tell you the whole story, I can write your term paper, and if there's an exam, you'll just have to bullshit as well as you can. If I tell you the whole story, maybe you'll actually remember some of it. The point is, I can do your homework for you. It's not hard for me, and I don't mind doing it, or I can teach you how to do your own homework. That would be a little harder for both of us, but it might turn out to be useful for you to be able to do your own work. I mean, what are you going to do after I'm gone?
What do you mean, after you're gone? I asked him.
Look at it another way, he said patiently. Are you going to get a job? After you're through with school, I mean. Are you going to work? Are you going to a university? Are we going to go to the same university? Am I going to do your homework there, too? What are you going to major in?
What are you going to major in? I asked him. My feelings were hurt, but I knew what he was driving at, and he was right.
Geology, he said. I'm in the granite business.
That's crazy, I said. It's not your business. You can study anything you want. You don't have to study rocks.
Rocks are interesting, Owen said stubbornly. Geology is the history of the earth.
I can't read Tess of the D'Urbervilles, I cried. It's too hard.
You mean it's hard to make yourself read it? You mean it's hard to make yourself pay attention, he said. But it's not Tess of the D'Urbervilles that's hard. Thomas Hardy may bore you, but he's very easy to understand. He's obvious. He tells you everything you have to know.
He tells me more than I want to know, I cried.
Your boredom is your problem, said Owen Meany. It's your lack of imagination that bores you. Hardy has the world figured out. Tess is doomed. Fate has it in for her. She's a victim. If you're a victim, the world will use you. Why should someone who's got such a worked-out way of seeing the world bore you? Why shouldn't you be interested in someone who's worked out a way to see the world? That's what makes writers interesting. Maybe you should be an English major. At least you get to read stuff that's written by people who can write. You don't have to do anything to be an English major. You don't need any special talent. You just have to pay attention to what someone wants you to see, to what makes someone angriest or the most excited in some other way. It's so easy. I think that's why there are so many English majors.
It's not easy for me, I cried. I hate reading this book.
Do you hate to read most books?
Owen asked me.
Yes, I said. Do you see that the problem is not Tess? He asked me.
Yes, I admitted.
Now we're getting somewhere, said Owen Meany.
My friend, my teacher. Standing on the sidewalk with Mrs. Brocklebank, I felt the tears start to come. Do you have allergies? Mrs. Brocklebank asked me. I shook my head. I feel so ashamed of myself that even for a moment, I could consider zapping my grade 12 girls with a nasty quiz on Tess of the D'Urbervilles. Remembering how I suffered as a student, remembering how much I needed Owen's help, how could I even think of being a sneaky teacher? I think you do have an allergy, Mrs. Brocklebank concluded from my tears. Lots of people have allergies and don't even know. I've read about that. It must be the dandelions, I said. And Mrs. Brocklebank glared at the pestilential weeds with a fresh hatred. Every spring, there are dandelions. They always remind me of the spring term of 1960, the burgeoning of that old decade that once seemed so new to Owen Meany and me. That was the spring when the search committee found a new headmaster. That was the decade that would defeat us. Randolph White had been the headmaster of a small private day school in Lake Forest, Illinois. I'm told that is a super-rich and exclusively WASP community that does its utmost to pretend it is not a suburb of Chicago. But that may be unfair. I've never been there. Several Gravesend students came from there, and they unanimously groaned to hear the announcement of Randolph White's appointment as headmaster at the academy. Apparently, the idea that anyone from Lake Forest had followed them to New Hampshire depressed them. At the time, Owen and I knew a kid from Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, and he told us that Bloomfield Hills was to Detroit what Lake Forest was to Chicago, and that, in his view, Bloomfield Hills sucked. He offered a story about Bloomfield Hills as an example of what he meant. It was a story about a black family that moved there, and they were forced to sell and move out because their neighbors kept burning crosses on their lawn. This shocked Owen and me. In New Hampshire, we thought such things happened only in the South, but a black kid from Atlanta informed us that we knew shit about the problem. They burned crosses all over the country, the black kid said, and we weren't exactly overwhelmed by a sea of black faces at Gravesend Academy, were we? No, Owen and I agreed, we were not. Then another kid from Michigan said that Grosse Pointe was more to Detroit what Lake Forest was to Chicago, that Bloomfield Hills wasn't a proper analogy, and some other kid argued that Shaker Heights was more to Cleveland what Lake Forest was to Chicago, and so forth. Owen and I were not very knowledgeable of the geography of the country's rich and exclusive. When a Jewish kid from Highland Park, Illinois, told us that there were no Jews allowed in Lake Forest, Owen and I began to wonder what ominous kind of small private day school in Lake Forest our new headmaster had come from. Owen had another reason to be suspicious of Randolph White. Of all the candidates whom the search committee dragged through the school in our 10th grade year, only Randolph White had not accepted the invitation for
a private audience
with the Voice. Owen had met Mr. White outside Archie Thorndike's office. Thorny introduced the candidate to The Voice and told them he would, as usual, vacate his office in order for them to be alone for Owen's interview.
"What's this?" Randolph White said. "I thought I already had the student interview."
"Well," old Thorny said, "Owen, you know, is The Voice. You know our school newspaper, The Grave?"
"I know who he is," Mr. White said.
He had still not shaken Owen's outstretched hand.
"Why didn't he interview me when the other students interviewed me?"
"That was the student subcommittee," Archie Thorndike explained. "Owen has requested a private audience."
"Request denied, Owen," said Randolph White, finally shaking Owen's small hand. "I want to have plenty of time to talk with the department heads," Mr. White explained.
Owen rubbed his fingers, which were still throbbing from the candidate's handshake. Old Thorny tried to salvage the disaster.
"Owen is almost a department head," he said cheerfully. "Student opinion isn't a department, is it?" Mr. White asked Owen, who was speechless.
White was a compact, trimly built man who played an aggressive, relentless game of squash daily. His wife called him Randy. He called her Sam from Samantha. She came from a meat money family in the Chicago area. His was a meat family background, too, although there was said to be more money in the meat she came from. One of the less-than-kind Chicago newspapers described their wedding as a meat marriage. Owen remembered from the candidate's dossier that White had been credited with revolutionizing packaging and distribution of meat products. He'd left meat for education rather recently, when his own children, in his opinion, were in need of a better school. He'd started one up, from scratch, and the school had been quite a success in Lake Forest. Now White's children were in college, and White was looking for a bigger challenge in the education business. In Lake Forest, he'd had no tradition to work with. White said he liked the idea of being a change-maker within a great tradition. Randy White dressed like a businessman. He looked exceedingly sharp alongside old Archie Thorndike's more rumpled and wrinkled appearance. White wore a steel-gray pinstriped suit with a crisp white shirt. He liked a thin gold collar pin that pulled the unusually narrow points of his collar a little too closely together. The pin also thrust the perfectly tight knot of his necktie a little too far forward. He put his hand on top of Owen Meany's head and rumpled Owen's hair. Before the famous nativity of 53, Barb Wiggin used to do that to Owen.
I'll talk to Owen after I get the job, White said to old Thorny. He smiled at his own joke. I know what Owen wants anyway, White said. He winked at Owen. An educator first, a fundraiser second. Isn't that it? Owen nodded, but he couldn't speak. Well, I'll tell you what a headmaster is, Owen. He's a decision maker. He's both an educator and a fundraiser, but first and foremost, he makes decisions. Then Randy White looked at his watch. He steered old Thorny back into the headmaster's office. Remember, I've got that plane to catch, White said. Let's get those department heads together. And just before old Archie Thorndike closed his office door, Owen heard what White said. In Owen's view, he was supposed to hear what White said. I hope that kid hasn't stopped growing, said Randy White. Then the door to the headmaster's office was closed. The voice was left speechless. The candidate had not heard a word from Owen Meany. Of course, the ghost of the future saw it coming. Sometimes I think Owen saw everything that was coming. I remember how he predicted that the school would pick Randolph White. For The Grave, the voice titled his column,
Whitewash!
He began,
The trustees like businessmen. The trustees are businessmen. The faculty are a bunch of typical teachers. Indecisive, wishy-washy. They're always saying, on the other hand. Now, along comes this guy who says his specialty is making decisions. Once he starts making those decisions, he'll drive everyone crazy. Wait until everyone sees what brilliant decisions the guy comes up with. But right now, everyone thinks someone who makes decisions is just what we need. Right now, everyone's a sucker for a decision maker, Owen wrote. What Gravesend needs is a headmaster with a strong educational background. Mr. White's background is meat.
There was more, and it was worse. Owen suggested that someone check into the admissions policy at the small private day school in Lake Forest. Were there any Jews or blacks in Mr. White's school? Mr. Early, in his capacity as faculty advisor to The Grave, killed the column. The part about the faculty being
typical teachers, indecisive, wishy-washy,
that was what forced Mr. Early's hand. Dan Needham agreed that the column should have been killed. You can't imply that someone is a racist or an anti-Semite, Owen, Dan told him. You have to have proof. Owen sulked about such a stern rejection from The Grave, but he took Dan's advice seriously. He talked to the Gravesend students who came from Lake Forest, Illinois. He encouraged them to write to their mothers and fathers and urged them to inquire about the admissions policy at Mr. White's school. The parents could pretend they were considering the school for their children. They could even ask directly if their children were going to be rubbing shoulders with blacks or Jews. The result, the unhappily second and third-hand information, was typically unclear. The parents were told that the school had no specific admissions policy. They were also told that the school had no blacks or Jews. Dan Needham had his own story about meeting Randy White. That was after White was offered the job. It was a beautiful spring day. The forsythia and the lilacs were in blossom, and Dan Needham was walking in the main quadrangle with Randy White and his wife Sam. It was Sam's first visit to the school, and she was interested in the theater. Almost immediately upon the White's arrival, Mr. White made his decision to accept the headmastership. Dan said the school had never looked prettier. The grass was trim and a spring green color, but it had not been mowed so recently that it looked shorn. The ivy was glossy against the red brick buildings, and the arborvitae and the privet hedges that outlined the quadrangle paths stood in uniform dark green contrast to the few bright yellow dandelions. Dan let the new headmaster maul the fingers of his right hand. Dan looked into the pretty blonde blandness of Sam's vacant, detached smile.
Look at those dandelions, dear, said Randolph White.
They should be ripped out by their roots, Mrs. White said decisively.
They should, and they will be, said the new headmaster.
Dan confessed to Owen and me that the Whites had given him the shivers.
You think they give you the shivers now?
Owen said.
Just wait until he starts making decisions.
Toronto, May 13th, 1987. Another gorgeous day, sunny and cool. Mrs. Brocklebank and others of my neighbors who were attacking their dandelions yesterday are having a go at their lawns today. It smells as fresh as a farm along Russell Hill Road and Lonsdale Road. I read the Globe and Mail again, but I was good. I didn't bring it to school with me, and I resolved that I would not discuss the sales of U.S. arms to Iran and the diversion of the profits to the Nicaraguan rebels or the gift from the Sultan of Brunei that was supposed to help support the rebels but was instead transferred to the wrong account in a Swiss bank, a $10 million mistake. The Globe and Mail said, Brunei was only one foreign country approached during the Reagan administration's attempt to find financial support for the Contras after Congress forbade any monies being spent on their behalf by the U.S. government. But in my grade 13 English class, the ever-clever Claire Clooney read that sentence aloud to the class and then asked me if I didn't think it was the awkwardest sentence alive. I have encouraged the girls to find clumsy sentences in newspapers and magazines and to bring them into class for our hearty ridicule, and that bit about any monies being spent is enough to turn an English teacher's eyeballs a blank shade of pencil gray. But I knew that Claire Clooney was trying to get me started. I resisted the bait. It is that time in the spring term when the minds of the grade 13 girls are elsewhere, and I reminded them that, yesterday, we had not traveled sufficiently far in our perusal of Chapter 3 of The Great Gatsby, that the class had bogged down in a mire of interpretations regarding the quality of eternal reassurance in Gatsby's smile, and that we'd wasted more valuable time trying to grasp the meaning of Jordan Baker exhibiting an urban distaste for the concrete. Claire Clooney, I might add, has such a general distaste for the concrete that she confused Daisy Buchanan with Myrtle Wilson. I suggested that mistaking a wife for a mistress was of more dire substance than a slip of the tongue. I suspect that Claire Clooney is too clever for an error of this magnitude, that yesterday she had not read past Chapter 1, and that today, by her ploy of distracting me with the news, she was not finished with Chapter 4.
"Here's another one, Mr. Wheelwright," Claire Clooney said, continuing her merciless attack on the Globe and Mail. "This is the second awkwardest sentence alive," she said. "Get this. Mr. Reagan denied yesterday that he had solicited third country aid for the rebels, as Mr. McFarlane had said on Monday." "That's some dangling clunker there, isn't it?" Claire Clooney asked me. "I like that. As Mr. McFarlane had said, it's just like tacked on to the sentence," she cried.
"Is it like tacked on, or is it tacked on?" I asked her. She smiled. The other girls tittered. They were not going to get me to blow a 40-minute class on Ronald Reagan. But I had to keep my hands under the desk, my fists under the desk, I should say. The White House, that whole criminal mob, those arrogant goons who see themselves as justified to operate above the law, they disgrace democracy by claiming that what they do for democracy. They should be in jail. They should be in Hollywood. I know that some of the girls have told their parents that I deliver ranting lectures to them about the United States. Some parents have complained to the headmistress, and Catherine has cautioned me to keep my politics out of the classroom. Or at least say something about Canada. BSS girls are Canadians, for the most part, you know. I don't know anything about Canada, I say. I know you don't, the Reverend Mrs. Keeling says, laughing. She is always friendly, even when she's teasing me, but the substance of her remark hurts me, if only because it is the same critical message that Canon Mackey delivers to me, without cease. In short, you've been with us for 20 years. When are you going to take an interest in us? In my grade 13 English class, Frances Noyes said,
I think he's lying.
She meant President Reagan, of course.
They should impeach him. Why can't they impeach him? Said Debbie LaRocca.
If he's lying, they should impeach him. If he's not lying, if all these other clowns are running his administration for him, then he's too stupid to be president. Either way, they should impeach him. In Canada, they'd call for a vote of confidence and he'd be gone. Sandra Darcy said, Yeah. What do you think, Mr. Wheelwright?
Adrian Hewlett asked me sweetly. I think that some of you have not read to the end of Chapter 4, I said. What does it mean that Gatsby was delivered suddenly from the womb of his purposeless splendor? What does that mean? I asked them. At least Ruby Newell had done her homework.
It means that Gatsby bought the house so that Daisy would be just across the bay, that all the parties he throws, in a way, he throws them for her. It means that he's not just crazy, that he's made all the money and he's spending all the money just for her. To catch her eye, you know, Ruby said. I like the part about the guy who fixed the World Series, Debbie LaRocca cried. Meyer Wolfshears, said Claire Clooney. Shime, I said softly. Meyer Wolfshime. Yeah, Sandra Darcy said. I like the way he says Augsford instead of Oxford, Debbie LaRocca said. Like he thinks Gatsby's an Augsford man, said Francis Noyes. I think the guy who's telling the story is a snob, said Adrian Hewlett. Nick, I said softly. Nick Carraway. Yeah, Sandra Darcy said. But he's supposed to be a snob. That's part of it. And when he says he's so honest, that he's one of the few honest people he's ever known, I think we're not supposed to trust him. Not completely, I mean, Claire Clooney said. I know he's the one telling the story, but he's a part of them. He's judging them, but he's one of them. They're trashy people, all of them, Sandra Darcy said.
Trashy? I asked.
They're very careless people, Ruby Newell said correctly.
Yes, I said. They certainly are. Very smart, these BSS girls. They know what's going on in the Great Gatsby. And they know what should be done to Ronald Reagan's rotten administration, too. But I contained myself very well in class today. I restricted my observations to the Great Gatsby. I bade the class to look with special care in the following chapters at Gatsby's notion that he can repeat the past, at Gatsby's observation of Daisy, that her voice is full of money, and at the frequency of how often Gatsby appears in moonlight, once at the end of Chapter 7, watching over nothing. I asked them to consider the coincidence of Nick's 30th birthday, the meaning of the sentence, "Before me stretched the portentous, menacing road of a new decade," might give our class as much trouble as the meaning of "an urban distaste for the concrete." And remember what Ruby said, I told them. They're very careless people. Ruby Newell smiled. Careless is how Fitzgerald himself described those characters. Ruby knew that I knew she had already read to the end of the book. They were careless people, the book says. They smashed up things and creatures, and then retreated back into their money or their vast carelessness, or whatever it was that kept them together, and let other people clean up the mess they had made. The Reagan administration is full of such careless people. Their kind of carelessness is immoral. And President Reagan calls himself a Christian. How does he dare? The kind of people claiming to be in communication with God today, they are enough to drive a real Christian crazy. And how about these evangelical types performing miracles for money? Oh, there's big bucks in interpreting the gospel for idiots, or in having idiots interpret the gospel for you. And some of these evangelists are even hypocritical enough to indulge in sexual activity that would embarrass former Senator Hart. Perhaps poor Gary Hart missed his true calling. Or are they all the same, these presidential candidates and evangelicals who are caught with their pants down? Mr. Reagan has been caught with his pants down, too. But the American people reserve their moral condemnation for sexual misconduct. Remember when the country was killing itself in Vietnam, and the folks at home were outraged at the length and cleanliness of the protesters' hair?
In the staff room, Evelyn Barber, one of my colleagues in the English department, asked me what I thought of the Contra-Aid article in the Globe and Mail. I said I thought that the Reagan administration exhibited an urban distaste for the concrete. That got quite a few laughs from my colleagues, who were expecting a diatribe from me. On the one hand, they complain about my predictable politics, but they are just like the students. They enjoy getting me riled up. I have spent 20 years teaching teenagers. I don't know if I've been a maturing influence on any of them, but they have turned me and my colleagues into teenagers. We teenagers are much maligned. For example, we would not keep Mr. Reagan in office. In the staff room, my colleagues were yapping about the school elections. The elections were yesterday when I noticed an impatient thrill in morning chapel, before the balloting for head girl. The girls sang Sons of God with even more pep than usual. How I love to hear them sing that hymn. There are verses only the voices of young girls can convincingly sing. Brothers, sisters, we are one, and our life has just begun. In the spirit, we are young. We can live forever. It was Owen Meany who taught me that any good book is always in motion, from the general to the specific, from the particular to the whole, and back again. Good reading, and good writing about reading, moves the same way. It was Owen, using Tess of the D'Urbervilles as an example, who showed me how to write a term paper, describing the incidents that determine Tess's fate by relating them to that portentous sentence that concludes Chapter 36. New growths insensibly bud upward to fill each vacated place. Unforeseen accidents hinder intentions, and old plans are forgotten. It was a triumph for me. By writing my first successful term paper about a book I'd read, I also learned to read. Most mechanically, Owen helped my reading by another means. He determined that my eyes wandered to both the left and to the right of where I was in a sentence, and that instead of following the elusive next word with my finger, I should highlight a spot on the page by reading through a hole cut in a piece of paper. It was a small rectangle, a window to read through. I moved the window over the page. It was a window that opened no higher than two or three lines. I read more quickly and more comfortably than I ever had read with my finger. To this day, I read through such a window. As for my spelling, Owen was more helpful than Dr. Dolder. It was Owen who encouraged me to learn how to type. A typewriter doesn't cure the problem, but I often can recognize that a typewritten word looks wrong. In longhand, I was and am a disaster. And Owen made me read the poems of Robert Frost aloud to him.
In my voice, they don't sound so good.
And so I memorized Nothing Gold Can Stay, and Fire and Ice, and Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. Owen memorized Birches, but that one was too long for me. That summer of 1960, when we swam in the abandoned quarry lake, we no longer tied a rope around ourselves or swam one at a time. Mr. Meany had either lost interest in the rule or in enforcing it, or he had acknowledged that Owen and I were no longer children. That was the summer we were 18. When we swam in the quarry, it didn't seem dangerous. Nothing seemed dangerous. That was the summer we registered for the draft, too. It was no big deal. When we were 16, we got our driver's licenses. When we were 18, we registered for the draft. At the time, it seemed no more perilous than buying an ice cream cone at Hampton Beach. On Sunday, when it was not a good beach day, Owen and I played basketball in the Gravesend Academy gym. The summer school kids had an outdoor sports program, and they were so stir-crazy on weekends that they went to the beach even when it rained. We had the basketball court to ourselves, and it was cool in the gym. There was an old janitor who worked the weekends and who knew us from the regular school year. He got us the best basketballs and clean towels out of the stock room, and sometimes he even let us swim in the indoor pool. I think he was a trifle retarded. He must have been damaged in some fashion, because he actually enjoyed watching Owen and me practice our idiotic stunt with the basketball, the leaping lift-him-up slam-dunk shot.
"Let's practice the shot,"
Owen would say. That was all we ever called it, the shot. We'd go over it again and again. He would grasp the ball in both hands and leap into my arms, but he never took his eyes from the rim of the basket. Sometimes he would twist in the air and slam the ball into the hoop backward. Sometimes he would dunk it with one hand. I would turn in time to see the ball in the net and Owen Meany descending, his hands still higher than the rim of the basket, but his head already below the net, his feet kicking the air. He always landed gracefully. Sometimes we could entice the old janitor to time us with the official scorer's clock.
"Set it to 8 seconds,"
Owen would instruct him. Over the summer, we twice managed the shot in under 5 seconds.
"Set it to 4,
Owen would say, and we'd keep practicing. Under 4 seconds was tough. When I'd get bored, Owen would quote me a little Robert Frost.
"One could do worse than be a swinger of birches."
In our wallets, in our pockets, the draft cards weighed nothing at all. We never looked at them. It wasn't until the fall term of 1960, with Headmaster White at the helm, that Gravesend Academy students found an interesting use for draft cards. Naturally, it was Owen Meany who made the discovery. He was in the office of the Grave, experimenting with a brand new photocopier. He found that he could copy his draft card. Then he found a way to make a blank draft card, one without a name and without a date of birth. The drinking age in New Hampshire was 21. Although Owen Meany didn't drink, he knew there were a lot of students at Gravesend Academy who liked to drink themselves silly, and none of them was 21. He charged $21 a card.
"That's the magic number," he said.
"Just make up your own birthday. Don't tell anyone where you got this. If you get caught, I don't know you."
It was the first time he'd broken the law. Unless you count the business with the tadpoles and toads and Mary Magdalene in her goal. Toronto, May 14, 1987. Another sunny morning, but rain developing. President Reagan is now taking the tack that he's proud of every effort he's made for the Contras, whom he calls the moral equivalent of our founding fathers. The president confirmed that he had discussed the matter of aid with King Fahd of Saudi Arabia. He's changed his story from only 2 days ago. The Globe and Mail pointed out that the king had brought up the subject. Does it matter who brought it up? "My diary shows I never brought it up," the president said. "I expressed pleasure that he was doing that." I never thought the president could do anything that would make me feel at all close to him. But Mr. Reagan keeps a diary, too. Owen kept a diary. The first entry was as follows.
"This diary was given to me for Christmas 1960 by my benefactor, Mrs. Harriet Wheelwright. It is my intention to make Mrs. Wheelwright proud of me."
I don't believe that Dan Needham and I thought of my grandmother as Owen's
benefactor.
Although, quite literally, that is what she'd become. But that Christmas of 1960, Dan and I, and Grandmother, had reason to be especially proud of Owen Meany. He'd had a busy fall. Randy White, our new headmaster, had also been busy. He'd been making decisions, left and right, and the voice had not allowed a single headmasterly move to pass unchallenged. The first decision had actually been Mrs. White's. She'd not liked the Thorndykes' old home. It was, traditionally, the headmaster's house. It had already housed 3 headmasters. 2 of them had died there. Old Thorny, when he retired, had moved to his former summer home in Rye, where he planned to live year-round. But the traditional house was not up to the Lake Forest standards that the Whites were used to. It was a well-kept colonial house on Pine Street. But it was Too old for the Whites, and too dark, she said, and too far from the main campus, he said, and a poor place to entertain, they both agreed. Apparently, Sam White liked to entertain.
Whom are they going to entertain?
Asked the voice, who was critical of what he called
the Whites' social priorities.
Indeed, it was an expensive decision, too. A new house was built for the headmaster, so central in its location that its ongoing construction was a campus eyesore throughout Owen's and my 11th grade year. There had been some problems with the architect, or else Mrs. White had changed her mind about a few of the interior particulars after the construction was in progress, hence the delay. It was a rather plain salt box.
Not in keeping with the older faculty houses,
as Owen pointed out. Also, its positioning interrupted a broad, beautiful expanse of lawn between the old library and the main academy building.
There's going to be a new library one day soon anyway, the headmaster said.
He was working up an expanded building proposal that included a new library, two new dormitories, a new dining hall, and, down the road, a new gym with co-educational facilities.
Co-education, the headmaster said, is a part of the future of any progressive school.
The voice said,
It is ironic and self-serving that the so-called expanded building proposal should begin with a new house for the headmaster. Is he going to entertain enough high-income alumni in that house to get the so-called capital fund drive off the ground? Is this the house that pays for everything, from the gym on down?
When the headmaster's house was finally ready for occupancy, the Reverend Mr. Merrill and his family were moved out of a rather crowded dormitory apartment and into the former headmaster's house on Pine Street. It was, impractically, at some distance from Hurd's Church, but the Reverend Lewis Merrill, as a newcomer to the school, must have been grateful to have been given such a nice old home. As soon as Randy White had done Mr. Merrill this favor, the headmaster made another decision. Morning chapel, which was daily, had always been held in Hurd's Church. It was not really a religious service, except for the ritual of singing and opening and closing hymn, and concluding the morning remarks or announcements with a prayer. The school minister did not usually officiate morning chapel. The most frequent officiant was the headmaster himself. Sometimes a faculty member gave us a mini-lecture in his field, or one of the students delivered an impassioned plea for a new club. Occasionally, something exciting happened. I remember a fencing demonstration. Another time, one of the alumni, who was a famous magician, gave us a magic show, and one of the rabbits escaped in Hurd's Church and was never found. What Mr. White decided was that Hurd's Church was too gloomy a place for us to start our mornings. He moved our daily assembly to the theater in the main academy building. The Great Hall, it was called. Although the morning light was more evident there, and the room had a high-ceilinged loftiness to it, it was at the same time austere. The towering portraits of former headmasters and faculty frowned grimly down upon us in their deep black academic regalia. The faculty who chose to attend morning chapel, they were not required to be there as we were, now sat on the elevated stage and looked down upon us too. When the stage was set for a school play, the curtain was drawn, and there was little room for the faculty on the narrow front of the stage. That was the first thing that Owen criticized about the decision. In Hurd's Church, the faculty had sat in pews with the students. The faculty felt encouraged to attend. But in the Great Hall, when one of Dan's plays was set on the stage, there was room for so few chairs that faculty attendance was discouraged. In addition, Owen felt that
the elevation of the stage and the brightness of the morning light provide the headmaster with such an exaggerated platform from which to speak, and often there's a kind of spotlight provided by the sun that gives us all the feeling that we're in the presence of an exalted personage. I wonder if this is the intended effect,
wrote the voice. I confess, I rather liked the change, which was popular with most students.
The Great Hall was on the second floor of the main Academy building. It could be approached from two directions, up two wide and sweeping marble staircases, through two high and wide double doors. There was no lining up to enter or leave, and many of us were already in the building for our first morning class. In the winter especially, it was a tramp to Hurd's Church, which was set off from all the classroom buildings. But Owen insisted that the headmaster was
grandstanding,
and that Randy White had skillfully manipulated the Reverend Mr. Merrill into a position where the minister would have felt ungrateful if he complained. After all, he had a good house to live in. If taking morning chapel from Hurd's Church was a move away from the Reverend Mr. Merrill's territory, and if the minister resented the change, we did not hear a word of protest from the quiet Congregationalist about it. Only the voice complained. But Randy White was just warming up. His next decision was to abolish the Latin requirement, a requirement that everyone, except the members of the Latin department, had moaned about for years. The old logic that Latin helped one's understanding of all languages was not a song that was often sung outside the Latin department. There were six members in the Latin department, and three of them were within a year or two of retirement. White anticipated that enrollment in Latin would drop in half of what it was. 3 years of the language had been a graduation requirement. In a year or two, there would be the correctly reduced number of teachers in the department to teach Latin, and new faculty could be hired in the more popular Romance languages, French and Spanish. There were cheers in morning meeting when White announced the change. In quite a short time, we had begun to call morning chapel by another name. White called it morning meeting, and the new name stuck. It was the way he had scrapped the Latin that was wrong, Owen pointed out.
It is shrewd of the new headmaster to make such a popular decision, and what could be more popular with students than abolishing a requirement? Latin, especially. But this should have been accomplished by a vote in faculty meeting. I'm sure that if the headmaster had proposed the change, the faculty would have endorsed it. The headmaster has a certain singular power, but was it necessary for him to demonstrate his power so whimsically? He could have achieved this goal more democratically. Was it necessary to show the faculty that he didn't need their approval? And was it actually legal under our charter or our constitution for the headmaster to change a graduation requirement all by himself?
That occasioned the first instance of the headmaster using the platform of morning meeting to answer the voice. We were, after all, a captive audience.
"Gentlemen," Mr. White began, "I do not have the advantage of what amounts to a weekly editorial column in the Grave, but I should like to use my brief time, between hymns and before our prayer, to enlighten you on the subject of our dear old school's charter and its constitution. In neither document is the faculty empowered with any authority over the school's chosen headmaster, who is designated as the principal, meaning the principal faculty member. In neither the charter nor the constitution are the decision-making powers of the headmaster or principal inhibited in any way. Let us pray." Mr. White's next decision was to replace our school attorney, a local lawyer, with an attorney friend from Lake Forest, the former head of a law firm that had successfully fought off a food poisoning suit against one of the big Chicago meat companies. Tainted meat had made a lot of people sick, but the Lake Forest attorney steered the blame away from the meat company and the packager and rested the fault upon a company of refrigeration trucks. On the advice of this attorney, Randy White changed the dismissal policy at Gravesend Academy. In the past, a so-called executive committee listened to the case of any boy who faced dismissal. That committee made its recommendation to the faculty, and the whole faculty voted for the boy to stay or go. The Lake Forest attorney suggested that the school was vulnerable to a lawsuit in the case of a dismissal, that the whole faculty was acting as a jury without the in-depth understanding of the case that was afforded to the executive committee.
The attorney advised that the executive committee make the entire decision regarding the boy's dismissal and the faculty not be involved. This was approved by Headmaster White, and the change was announced, in the manner of dropping the Latin requirement, in morning meeting.
"For the sake of avoiding a hypothetical lawsuit," wrote Owen Meany, "the headmaster has changed a democracy to an oligarchy. He has taken the future of a boy in trouble out of the hands of many and placed the fate of that boy into the hands of a few. And let us examine these few. The executive committee is composed of the headmaster, the dean of students, the director of scholarships, and 4 members of the faculty, only 2 of whom are elected by the whole faculty. The other 2 are appointed by the headmaster. I suggest that this is a stacked deck. Who knows any boy best? His dorm advisor, his current teachers and coaches. In the past, in faculty meeting, these were the people who spoke up in a boy's defense. Or they were the people who knew best that the boy did not deserve defending. I suggest that any boy who is dismissed by this executive committee should sue the school. What better grounds are there for a lawsuit in the case of a dismissal than these? The people in a position to know best the value of your contribution to the school are not in a position to even speak in your defense, not to mention vote. I warn you, anyone who gets sent up before this executive committee is already a goner. The headmaster and his 2 appointees vote against you. The 2 elected faculty members of the committee vote for you. Now you're behind 3-2. And what do the dean of students and the director of scholarships do? They don't know you from the classroom or from the gym or from the dorm. They're administrators, like the headmaster. Maybe the director of scholarships looks kindly on you if you're a scholarship boy. That way, you lose 4-3 instead of 5-2. Either way, you lose. Look up oligarchy in the dictionary if you don't know what I mean. A form of government in which the power is vested in a few persons or in a dominant class or clique. Government by the few.
But there were other issues of government that captured everyone's attention at the time. Even Owen was distracted from the decision-making capacities of the new headmaster. Everyone was talking about Kennedy or Nixon, and it was Owen who initiated a mock election among the Gravesend Academy students. He organized it, he set up the balloting in the school post office, he seated himself behind a big table and checked off every student's name. He caught a few kids voting twice. He sent runners to bother kids in the dorm who had not yet voted. For 2 days, he spent all his time between classes behind that big table. He wouldn't let anyone else be the checker. The ballots themselves were secured in a locked box that was kept in the Director of Scholarship's office, whenever it was out of Owen's sight. There he sat at the table with a campaign button as big as a baseball on the lapel of his sport jacket, all the way with JFK. He wanted a Catholic.
"There's no monkey business about this election," he told the voters. "If you're enough of an asshole to vote for Nixon, your dumb vote will be counted, just like anybody else."
Kennedy won in a landslide, but the voice predicted that the real vote, in November, would be much closer. Yet Owen believed that Kennedy would and should triumph.
"This is an election that young people can feel a part of," announced the voice.
Indeed, although Owen and I were too young to vote, we felt very much a part of all that youthful vigor that Kennedy represented.
"Wouldn't it be nice to have a president whom people under 30 won't laugh at? Why vote for Eisenhower's 5 o'clock shadow when you can have Jack Kennedy?"
Once again, the headmaster saw fit to challenge the editorial nature of the voice in morning meeting.
"I am a Republican," Randy White told us. "So that you don't think that the grave represents Republicans with even marginal objectivity, allow me to take a minute of your time. While perhaps the euphoria of John Kennedy's landslide election here is still high, but I hope subsiding. I'm not surprised that so youthful a candidate has charmed many of you with his vigor,
But, fortunately, the fate of the country is not decided by young men who are not old enough to vote. Mr. Nixon's experience may not seem so glamorous to you, but a presidential election is not a sailing race or a beauty contest between the candidates' wives. I'm an Illinois Republican, the headmaster said. Illinois is the land of Lincoln, as you boys know.
Illinois is the land of Adlai Stevenson, Owen Meany wrote. As far as I know, Adlai Stevenson is a more recent resident of Illinois than Abraham Lincoln. As far as I know, Adlai Stevenson is a Democrat, and he's still alive.
And this little difference of opinion, as far as I know, was what prompted Randy White to make another decision. He replaced Mr. Early as the faculty advisor to the grave. Mr. White made himself the faculty advisor, and so the voice was presented with a more adversarial censor than Owen had ever faced in Mr. Early. You'd better be careful, Owen, Dan Needham advised.
You better watch your ass, man, I told him.
It was a very cold evening after Christmas when he pulled the tomato red pickup into the parking lot behind St. Michael's, the parochial school. His headlights shone across the playground, which had been flooded by an earlier, unseasonable rain that had now frozen to the black, reflecting sheen of a pond.
"Too bad we don't have our skates," Owen said.
At the far end of the smooth sheet of ice, the truck's headlights caused the statue of Mary Magdalene to glow in her goal.
"Too bad we don't have our hockey sticks and a puck," Owen said.
A light went on, and then another light, in the salt box where the nuns lived. Then the porch light was turned on, too, and two of the nuns came out on the porch and stared at our headlights.
"Ever see penguins on ice?" Owen said.
"Better not do anything," I advised him, and he turned the truck around in the parking lot and drove to 80 Front Street.
There was a creature feature on The Late Show. Owen and I were now of the opinion that the only good movies were the really bad ones. He never showed me what he wrote in his diary, not then. But after that Christmas, he often carried it with him, and I knew it was important to him because he kept it by his bed, on his night table, right next to his copies of Robert Frost's poems, and under the guardianship of my mother's dressmaker's dummy. When he spent the night with me, at Dan's or at 80 Front Street, he always wrote in the diary before he allowed me to turn out the light. The night I remember him writing most furiously was the night following President Kennedy's inauguration. That was in January of 1961, and I kept begging him to turn the light out. But he went on, just writing and writing, and I finally fell asleep with the light on. I don't know when he stopped. We'd watched the inauguration on television at 80 Front Street. Dan and my grandmother watched with us, and although my grandmother complained that Jack Kennedy was too young and too handsome, that he looked like a movie star, and that he should wear a hat, Kennedy was the first Democrat that Harriet Wheelwright had ever voted for, and she liked him. Dan and Owen and I were crazy about him. It was a bright, cold, and windy day in Washington and in Gravesend, and Owen was worried about the weather.
"It's too bad it couldn't be a nicer day," Owen said.
"He should learn to wear a hat. It won't kill him," my grandmother complained. "In this weather, he'll catch his death."
When our old friend Robert Frost tried to read his inaugural poem, Owen became most upset. Maybe it was the wind, maybe Frost's eyes were tearing in the cold, or else it was the glare from the sun, or simply that the old man's eyesight was failing. Whatever, he looked very feeble, and he couldn't read his poem properly. "The land was ours before we were the land's," Frost began. It was the gift outright, and Owen knew it by heart.
"Someone help him!"
Owen cried, when Frost began to struggle. Someone tried to help him. Maybe it was the president himself or Mrs. Kennedy. I don't remember. It was not much help in any case, and Frost went on struggling with the poem. Owen tried to prompt him, but Robert Frost could not hear the voice, not all the way from Gravesend.
Owen recited from memory. His memory of the poem was better than Frost's.
Something we were withholding made us weak, until we found out that it was ourselves we were withholding from our land of living, and forthwith found salvation in surrender.
It was the same voice that had prompted the announcing angel, who'd forgotten his lines 8 years ago. It was the Christ child speaking from the manger again.
Jesus, why can't anyone help him?
Owen cried. It was the president's speech that really affected us. It left Owen Meany speechless and had him writing in his diary into the small hours of the night. Some years later, after everything, I would get to read what he had written. At the time, I knew only how excited he was, how he felt that Kennedy had changed everything for him.
No more sarcasm, Master, he wrote in the diary. No more cynical, negative, smart-ass, adolescent bullshit. There is a way to be of service to one's country without being a fool. There is a way to be of use without being used, without being a servant of old men and their old ideas.
There was more, much more. He thought that Kennedy was religious, and, incredibly, he didn't mind that Kennedy was a Catholic.
I believe he's a kind of savior, Owen wrote in his diary. I don't care if he's a mackerel snapper. He's got something we need.
In scripture class, Owen asked the Reverend Mr. Merrill if he didn't agree that Jack Kennedy was
the very thing Isaiah had in mind. You know, the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shined. You remember that?
Well, Owen, Mr. Merrill said cautiously, I'm sure Isaiah would have liked John Kennedy. I don't know, however, if Kennedy was the very thing Isaiah had in mind, as you say.
For to us a child is born, Owen recited. To us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder. Remember that?
I remember. And I remember how long it was after Kennedy's inauguration that Owen Meany would still recite to me from Kennedy's speech.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Remember that?
Chapter 7 The Dream. Owen and I were 19-year-old seniors at Gravesend Academy, at least a year older than the other members of our class, when Owen told me point-blank what he had expressed to me symbolically when he was 11 and had mutilated my armadillo.
God has taken your mother,
he said to me, when I was complaining about practicing the shot. I thought he would never slam dunk the ball in under 4 seconds, and I was bored with all our trying.
My hands were the instrument, he said. God has taken my hands. I am God's instrument.
That he might have thought such a thing when he was 11, when the astonishing results of that foul ball were such a shock to us both, and when whatever
unspeakable outrage
his parents had suffered had plunged his religious upbringing into confusion and rebellion, I could understand him thinking anything then, but not when we were 19. I was so surprised by the matter-of-fact way he simply announced his insane belief,
God has taken my hands,
that when he jumped into my hands, I dropped him. The basketball rolled out of bounds. Owen didn't look much like
God's instrument
in his fallen position, holding his knee, which he twisted in his fall, and writhing around on the gym floor under the basket. If you're God's instrument, Owen, I said, how come you need my help to stuff a basketball? It was Christmas vacation 1961, and we were alone in the gym, except for our old friend and our only audience, the retarded janitor, who operated the official scorer's clock whenever Owen was in the mood to get serious about timing the shot. I wish I could remember his name. He was often the only janitor on duty during school holidays and summer weekends,
and there was a universal understanding that he was retarded or brain-damaged, and Owen had heard that the janitor had suffered shell shock in the war. We didn't even know which war. We didn't know what shell shock even was. Owen sat on the basketball court, rubbing his knee.
"I suppose you heard that faith can move mountains," he said. "The trouble with you is, you don't have any faith."
"The trouble with you is, you're crazy," I told him. But I retrieved the basketball. "It's simply irresponsible," I said, "for someone your age and of your education to go around thinking he's God's instrument."
"I forgot I was talking to Mr. Responsibility," he said.
He'd started calling me Mr. Responsibility in the fall of 61, when we were engaged in that senior year agony commonly called college entrance applications and interviews. Because I'd applied to only the state university, Owen said I'd taken zero responsibility for my own self-improvement. Naturally, he'd applied to Harvard and Yale. As for the state university, the University of New Hampshire had offered him a so-called Honor Society scholarship, and Owen hadn't even applied for admission there. The New Hampshire Honor Society gave a special scholarship each year to someone they selected as the state's best high school or prep school student. You had to be a bona fide resident of the state, and the prize scholarship was usually awarded to a public school kid who was at the top of his or her graduating class. But Owen